Good afternoon. I'll call this meeting of the House Finance and Policy Committee to order. And note we have a quorum present. First order of business is approval of the minutes. Lee Johnson, have you had a chance to review the minutes for February 28th?
Chair Howard, I've reviewed them and I make a motion to approve.
A motion to approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The minutes are approved. First up today, we have House File 3591, Representative Igbaje's bill. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Igbaje moves that House File 3591 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And Representative Igbaje, I understand you have the DE3 amendment. Would you describe it, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The DE3 amendment cuts down the bill significantly. So the three focus areas of the bill now are the bill adds a penalty and or a remedy to several areas throughout 504B that did not have a specifically stated penalty or remedy when violated. And so it goes through a majority of 504B to add those remedies and penalties, and we can talk more about those, but we list a number of sections. The second piece of the bill also now focuses on the covenants of habitability and its extension to include common areas of the property to ensure the safety of all of the areas where a family may call home. And then finally, the third piece of the DE3 is that we also add a duty to mitigate in Minnesota. So the duty to mitigate, particularly for residential landlord leases, means that if someone needs to leave their lease early, the landlord now would have a responsibility to mitigate those damages by renting out the unit as soon as reasonably possible. So, for example, it would mean that a tenant would only be responsible for rent during the months that the unit remained vacant. For example, if you had a 12-month lease, and let's say you left that lease after 7 months with 5 months remaining, with a duty to mitigate, a tenant would only be on the hook for anywhere from maybe perhaps 1 to 3 months, depending on how long it took to rent out that property again of that unit, rather than the remainder of the entire lease, which is the case in Minnesota right now. The purpose is to encourage landlords to rent out their properties and hopefully keep the market moving. And a duty to mitigate also clarifies that when a landlord does rent out the unit, it would prevent a landlord from collecting rent from both the former tenant and the new tenant for the same time periods. So with this DE3 amendment added onto the bill, that puts the bill in the shape that we want, and we hope that this bill continues to address some of the issues in landlord-tenant law that make it harder for tenants to enjoy their homes, also harder for them to hold their landlords accountable. And the clarity that we seek through this amendment can ensure and provide that it's simpler for both tenants and landlords to understand each of their responsibilities and to know the steps that they must take to rectify situations of conflict. So with that, we'll go to the adoption of the DE3 amendment, and then I'll turn it over to testifiers.
Is there any discussion to the DE3? All right. All those in favor of the DE3 say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? DE3 is adopted. Representative Igbaje, to your bill.
Yes. Yeah, so that is really the purpose of the bill, of what's everything is in the DE3 amendment. As I stated, we are bringing forward this bill to continue on with ensuring that landlord-tenant law continues to be more favorable with both tenants and landlords, to bring that clarity, that specificity, and that understanding to both parties. We are, of course, always encouraging for folks to have continued open conversations with each other. But for the situations when things break down, it's appropriate to know what's at stake, what are the penalties, what are the remedies, and what are the procedures to follow. And so with that, I'll turn it over to testifiers.
Welcome to the committee.
Hello. My name is Rachel Sterling. Good afternoon, Chair Howard and members of the committee. I'm a housing attorney with Homeline. We're a nonprofit that helps tenants across the state of Minnesota with free and confidential legal advice. Since opening in 1992, we have advised over 315,000 renter households from every county in the state. And last year alone, we advised over 20,000 households. Because we work directly with so many tenants, we have unique insight into the issues facing many of those tenants. I want to share just a quick example of why these changes are needed. So this is a lease that we had that we went through, and you can kind of see when I flipped through it, I apologize, I had a different visual, but the computer system didn't work well for me. You can kind of see all the different colors that are in here, right? So 52% of this lease, 52 pages long, and 52% of that lease has terms or clauses that are beneficial for landlords. 6% of the lease has terms or clauses that are beneficial specifically for tenants. The rest of it is either restatements of the current law as it is or offers a neutral term that benefits neither one party or, you know, the other. So it's no secret that landlords write leases, and they understandably write them so they benefit themselves in those terms. Landlords effectively write their own rules and regulations with every lease, and tenants have very little power to negotiate over what those terms are. The most effective way to find any kind of fair balance between parties, then, is to protect tenants is through statutes and ordinances, which is why we're here today. So this bill aims to clarify, modernize, and create more equity for tenants by creating and or expanding enforcement options for tenants, creating a landlord duty to attempt to re-rent a property when a tenant has to move out mid-lease, and finally, updating and clarifying rules relating to habitability. We urge this committee to support House File 3591. So first off, enforcement. So for several decades, there have been landlord-tenant laws in place that are supposed to help ensure tenants are treated fairly, but they lack any sort of meaningful enforcement. If there is no way that tenants can make a landlord follow a rule, then there's very little incentive for landlords to comply with the law. And if there are no consequences for breaking a rule, then it's not much of a rule at all. So the proposed changes would add language that prevents the waiver of the statutes in 504B that do not already have a non-waiver language. It creates the right for tenants to recover treble actual and consequential damages or penalties ranging from $250 to $1,000 for violations of existing statutes, depending on the severity of the impact and damage that the violation can create. Lastly, there would be an increase in many penalties that were set decades ago, so that they are actually preventative and commensurate with the potential harm done. Next, the landlord duty to mitigate. So as Representative Abaje said, the duty to mitigate is a term that just refers to the obligation someone has to make a reasonable effort to limit the amount of harm they suffer, and it is often codified by law or through judicial decisions. Minnesota is one of the very few states that does not recognize a landlord's duty to mitigate damages when a tenant moves out mid-lease. If a tenant does not move out mid-lease, or excuse me, if the tenant does have to move out mid-lease, then currently the landlord can legally just let the property remain vacant. Under this proposed statute, landlords would have to make a reasonable effort to re-rent the empty unit, but would still be entitled to damages suffered because the tenant broke the lease. Finally, habitability. Habitability is one of those issues, it's the most common issue, in fact, that we see come into our hotline. These issues range from maintenance concerns like leaking faucets to more catastrophic situations like fire damage. So when a building becomes uninhabitable, current Minnesota law states that the tenant may leave, but one of the problems with these laws is that the terms uninhabitable, unfit for occupancy, or even destroyed are not defined, and so are entirely based on the circumstances. The proposed language would attempt to ensure tenants do not blindly walk into potentially uninhabitable situations by requiring landlords to disclose any inspection order repairs from the past year, and would limit a landlord's ability to collect rent from properties that have been ordered to be vacated by either a federal, state, or local authority. Luckily, most habitability issues do not involve whether a unit is fit for it to live in or not. Most of the habitability-related proposals in this bill, then, are really just clarifying and or codifying existing case law regarding a landlord's obligation to keep the rental property in reasonable repair. So, for example, the list of remedies proposed for 504B.161 have all been granted by courts over the years. The proposed changes would also clarify that landlords are responsible for maintaining common areas and are responsible for things like lawn care and snow removal unless the tenant is compensated for that work. These changes will help ensure tenants are better able to utilize their rights and put them on more equitable footing with their landlords. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Lugene Flores. Okay, next we have Cecil Smith. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cecil Smith. I serve as the President and CEO of the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association, a nonprofit trade association representing 2,200 members with 300,000 rental units serving over 600,000 Minnesotans. Today I'm here to respectfully express MHA's position on House File 3591 as amended. I want to first acknowledge the changes made in the DE3 amendment. We're continuing to evaluate the proposal, but we appreciate the author's amendment, which creates a more manageable proposal to consider. As housing providers, we are dedicated to offering safe, dignified housing to our residents. However, we are concerned that the proposed bill, with its expansive scope of damages, broadening of regulated activities, and lack of clarity on critical terms, could foster a litigious environment, increasing operational costs, and ultimately discourage investment in Minnesota's rental housing market. The bill's broad expansion of treble damages in a seemingly arbitrary manner risks creating an environment that may not only complicate the contractual relationship between renters and housing providers, but also lead to higher costs due to increased litigation. The requirement to disclose all inspection orders, even if caused by resident actions issued in the previous 12 months, adds a significant administrative burden. Definitions are unclear or lacking, such as abandonment or surrender. The covenants of habitability are greatly expanded, including situations where necessary repairs or upgrades must be performed to common areas or amenities, such as the pool, gym facilities, or bike storage, with the expectation of compensation. Finally, the proposal instructs the courts how to interpret the law, quote, liberally construed for the benefit of tenants, end quote, rather than removing the ambiguity in the law. Minnesota faces a significant housing shortage, and fostering an environment conducive to investment is critical. We fear that further regulatory burdens will deter the essential investments needed to meet our future housing needs. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony today.
Thank you. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? Oh, sure. Go ahead, sir. Welcome
Hi,
to the committee.
Hughes, welcome. Thanks for having me on the committee, and Mr. Chairman, thanks for your time. I'm going to remain pretty much neutral on this because I happen to sit upstairs, but I wanted to point out a few things. I understand the landlord-tenant relationships because at one time we had apartment buildings. I no longer do, but I got into a situation, as I told you the day, I think my father passed away, and I'm living in Legend in Cottage Grove, and so now I'm renting. It's going pretty well, but I hear from residents there that the rent keeps going up and so on and so forth. Now, the concern here is that it's a 55 and older apartment building, and a lot of our people are on fixed incomes. So if you keep upping the rent, which you have to because inflation increases, operations costs go on, but it's a new building, then that's going to force people to take other action and move other places. And that's my concern because these are my friends and neighbors, and we try to protect the elderly and vulnerable, and we get some great people there. We don't want to see anybody get hurt. So I'm asking the committee to take careful thought, and we need to move the bill along, that's for sure. But I'm asking to take careful thought and have some really explicit discussion because there are so many mechanical parts to this bill, and we want to be sure that the people of Minnesota are protected. And I also want to say that if you look nationwide, Minnesota isn't the only state this is happening in. A good share of them across the country are and have the same problem, and we need to do the best we can for both parties. But one has to be listen well to each other, and we have to have a happy meeting. One can't be fighting the other, otherwise we're going to have problems. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I think we will move on to, oh, there is another testifier. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and provide your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Howard and committee members. Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the executive director of MICA, the Metropolitan Interfaith Council on Affordable Housing. I am also the co-lead for the legislative team for Homes for All, which supports this bill. I'm also the president and CEO of Integrated Community Solutions, that is also does rental property in rural northern Minnesota. I think as you saw the lease that was shown to you a few minutes ago and the number of pages of that, I think it's important that we continue to remember that 54% of Americans read at sixth grade reading level and below, and 21% are illiterate. So it's so important that we have very plain language in all the different pieces of paperwork that we're providing for people in leases. And I think this legislation begins to help clarify that and make that much simpler. And I can just say, as a person who experienced homelessness 50 years ago, is I'm very thankful to the landlord that I was renting from at 19 when I got hurt in sports and could no longer work, in that he mitigated the situation by renting out the unit. So really appreciate the support. I hope that the committee will support this. Thank you.
Thank you. Move on to member discussion. I had Representative Nash on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the author, I think there is a little bit of a reset on some things. You talked about trying to balance the penalties that were tilted in the direction of housing providers, and there are now a new 28 provisions that would penalize housing providers, if I got my numbers correct?
Representative Bajaj.
Mr. Chair, I haven't done a full count yet just because we are still in negotiations about all the different pieces as the bill moves on. But it's more that the sections of law that did not previously before specify what the remedy or penalty would be for a violation of that section now has that. So that's how I would frame it.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess rather than kind of set the clock to zero so that it was more fair and balanced to both parties involved, it's now tilted more in the direction with new 28, and we did do the math. Can you tell me what reasonably possible for re-renting because you said 1 to 3 months, and I guess my question along those lines is, what if it surpasses 3 months? Because that seemed to be a number you repeated several times. So is 3 months where the faucet turns off, or what if it's the full term of the balance of the lease? Are the land, housing providers still able to collect the rent that is now being, deprived to them?
Representative Bajaj?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, if I think I understand your question, you're referring to the one example I gave of what would happen in a duty to mitigate situation. So in states that do have duty to mitigate, the landlord has to make reasonable efforts to re-rent the unit. Mm-hmm. If they are unable to re-rent the unit after making reasonable efforts, then of course the previous tenant is still on the hook for the remainder of the lease. Now, in a state that has duty to mitigate, if you are able to re-rent that unit, and it takes as long as it takes. So if in the example I gave, if you left after 7 months and there were 5 months remaining and they were only able to get someone for that last month, then the previous tenant would be on the hook for the 4 months out of the five.
Representative Nash.
Yeah, I guess in reading the newly engrossed bill, it just seems to have swung the pendulum in the other direction, heavy towards the renter. And I guess naively thought that it would be sort of a resetting and trying to make it as equitable to both parties as possible, making it hopefully easier for people who were leaving, but also not penalizing those who are providing the housing, which this, with the addition of 28 penalties into the bill, seems a little prescriptive, a little heavy-handed. So I'll be voting no. I may have other questions, Mr. Chair, but I'll let other folks jump in as well.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Battier, I understand what you're trying to do here. As the Representative Nash points, I think it's pendulum swinging a little too far one direction. It was interesting, giving the definition of the lease. I think that was, yes, it's a lot. I don't know if you've ever closed on a house. The amount of paperwork, if you wanted to read it like you should, you'd have to be there 2 days ahead of time to start reading. But what I enjoyed hearing about in that lease that we were shown is that the housing provider actually provided the renter with the statute, let him know what the laws are, which I think was a good thing. Now, the new bill, there's some terminology I guess I'd like to get a definition for. numerous times, I think it's 14 times, the term liberally construed for the sake and benefit of the renter. Can you explain why that is and what it means?
Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lee Johnson. I think that's an excellent question. As we have been talking about in Housing Committee for the number of years that I've been here, and then especially I know last year, we have talked about how the majority of the structure very much focuses on the ability and ease for landlords to be able to use the system. I myself have heard from certain referees that the eviction courts or the housing courts are known to be landlord courts. So what we've been trying to do is ensure that there is slightly more balance or at least more opportunities for a tenant to be able to hold their landlord accountable. So the liberally construed language is meant to signal that and signify that if you're in a situation where there might be a tie or you may not necessarily know, it might be more ambiguous, to think about it from the perspective of the tenant. This type of language has shown up in other areas of law, like our consumer protection laws, and it also has shown up in 504B, I believe, 0.161, sorry, also in 504B, 0.161, in current statute right now. So that's kind of where this language is coming from and where we're taking it from to ensure that the person who has the least power in the situation, if there is an ambiguity or if it might be a tie, that the courts and the judges are looking to ensure that the person who has the least power has an opportunity here to receive some compensation.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badger. So in other words, if it's a 50-50, you're giving the weight to one side and the other instead of letting the judge make the informed decision.
Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lee Johnson. No, the judge still makes an informed decision. It's just that if they, this is just a direction to them that if they really don't know where to go or if it's truly ambiguous for them, that's a consideration that they should consider. But at the end of the day, we know that judges are going to take the facts that are in front of them, and if the decision is against the tenant, the decision will be against the tenant. And if the decision is against the landlord, the decision will be against the landlord.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Badger. But the way it's written, it puts favor into the leasee and not the property owner instead of being neutral, which our bills, they should be neutral to make sure that it's fair for everybody. The other thing on here with what the Representative Nash was talking about with the re-rent, does what's the current statute now if somebody moves out, notifies their landlord, and the landlord's able to get somebody else in, or the housing provider is able to get somebody in there to rent the place? Is the original leasee still responsible for the remainder of the lease?
Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lee Johnson. I think it would depend on the type of negotiation that the former tenant and the landlord have, because we don't have a statute like this in Minnesota. All we have is case law, and the case law in Minnesota states that a landlord does not have a responsibility to re-rent the unit. If they do re-rent the unit, I think most landlords probably just continue on the relationship with the new tenant and then leave the previous tenant alone. But I can also ask my testifier to provide some more details.
Ms. Sterling.
Thank you. Absolutely correct. There's no statute that governs this. Mostly then it's dealt on as contract law. And so, yes, if the landlord does re-rent as, halfway through the lease term after the tenant moves out, then the other tenant's obligation, their liability, does end. However, most landlords already do this because it makes decent business sense, because for the landlord to collect on damages, they have to wait until the end of the lease term in order to collect. And so if there are those 5 months that Representative Agbaji was using as an example, that's how long they have to wait to collect on that. And so most landlords don't bother waiting that long.
Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Agbaji. Actually, a Minnesota case law does not allow them to collect already if they've rented the apartment out. So there's many things I have concerns about this bill. Our long-term care providers are very nervous. We're short on that as well. I think this bill still needs a lot of work. I'm not sure. I think we need to sit down with all the stakeholders on this and work it out better and get some clarity in some of this stuff. So I'm going to ask my members not to vote for this. I am going to ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested, so we will take a roll call on this vote. I'm not seeing other members. Oh, Representative Myers.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Bajet. Just two questions. One, when you were drafting this bill, and it goes back to what Nash was talking about a little bit, but I'm just, from your perspective or the testifier's perspective, what would you say is reasonable efforts to help mitigate those damages?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Bajet.
Sorry, I'm trying to understand your question. So reasonable efforts under which section?
So it's the one to help mitigate the damages. Is it putting it on one website? Is it posting it in the paper? I'm just, for this committee, I'm just trying to figure out your intent when you were drafting this of what you think would be reasonable. I know you're not a judge, but.
No,
Representative Bajet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers. Appreciate the clarification. No, I do not want to be a judge. So for reasonable efforts, I mean, I think we're looking at what landlords would typically do to rent out a unit that they have. So whether that's posting it to a website, posting it in a newspaper, calling folks, putting up a sign in their, on their property, on their website saying, So I think any of the traditional or customary methods that landlords use to rent out their units is what would be construed as reasonable efforts.
Representative Myers.
And a follow-up to that, maybe if I could ask the testifier, from your experience, what do you see landlords doing? Is one thing enough? Is multiple things? Just kind of from your experience.
Ms. Sterling.
It really depends on the landlord. Some of the larger companies have websites, and so they just make it part of their pool of what's available in their various buildings. Some landlords, it's a room in their home, and so they post something, on the board at the local bar. It varies from landlord to landlord. And so what's reasonable is going to vary from landlord to landlord.
And thank you for that. And I just ask, and I know the precedent in other states is probably there. Just trying to help out people that, are housing providers and what the expectation is going to be. And then the final question I had is, do you know what other areas of law in Minnesota allow for treble damages?
Representative Bajet.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Myers. I mean, throughout 504B already, we do have areas that allow for treble damages. And I don't know off the top of my head, but I mean, we could ask our research staff to find for us other areas in law where there are treble damages allowed. And I think that is depending on what the violation is sometimes a penalty. But I'll see if Ms. Sterling has any further insight.
I sorry, do not off the top of my head can think of a statute number that I can quote with absolute positivity for that.
And Myers?
Yes,
go ahead,
Chair. And the reason I bring it up is I'm trying to figure out if this is standard practice or if this is extraordinary circumstances that's being put in there, because as we said, there is a lot of damage provisions in here that may be a little excessive. So thank you.
Representative Dodseth.
Thank you, Chair Howard. Representative, just an observation. My understanding in Minneapolis-St. Paul, we have about, 70% occupancy right now of rental properties, maybe that's give or take. I'm just curious, how is this going to help improve additional rental units in the city and in the state of Minnesota? And the question I've got is, I heard mentioned that the contract law for a lease, you said it was how big? Testify over there.
I'll go to, I think there's two questions there, but I'll go to Ms. Sterling first. And then if you want to just follow up and answer that first on Representative Baje.
Thank you, Chair. Is this, you met this one?
Yep.
So this is 52 pages long. It's from a national association. It's a lease that we see commonly throughout Minnesota being used. Honestly, we see longer ones, we see shorter ones. Leases, there is no singular lease that is available out there. So. But this is a common one.
When you say common, is it more of national investors that are doing that, or more of the mom-and-pop residents that are renting out their properties?
Ms. Sterling.
It's, you're right. Usually the larger, this is from the National Apartments Association, uh-huh. Technically, so it is folks who may, we usually see it with the larger organizations, but that doesn't prevent a smaller landlord from utilizing it if they wanted to pay for that service.
I'm assuming most of that would be just addressing liability issues as far as the unit themselves and preserving, protecting their asset. Is that what majority of that language would be in there?
Ms. Sterling?
Yes, some of it is absolutely that. I can't say it's the majority of it. It goes everywhere from, liability for damages. It goes to utilities. It goes to rules of what the tenant is and is not allowed to do on the premises, court costs, fees, the things that you would expect in a contract, but also very, very long and detailed.
Representative Dotson?
Just a follow-up on that would be, I'm assuming when they acquire the property, they'd sign a mortgage, and the housing provider actually has liability as well. When they enter that contract, that's probably that thick. It's probably reasonable to say that it's not unreasonable for them to want to protect their asset. What in those leases do you find that's unreasonable?
I think we're getting a little far afield from the bill that's before us. But, Ms. Sterling, if you have a comment, and then we'll,
and I'll get to my point.
Okay.
I would just say that it's a 52-page lease for a year rental. So it is a lot to get through in a often pressurized short amount of time.
Final comment, that's it?
I guess my final comment would be, I guess my concern is, I just ask that we would tap the brakes on this a little bit, because I see that we could actually create a lack of housing in our communities, just because it may discourage future investors to actually provide housing in our communities because of this. Thank you.
And Representative Nash wanted a second bite of the apple. He did made this motion, so he's got just a short question. So.
Yeah. So thank you, Mr. Chair. How is the measurement of reasonableness for the effort that the housing provider is going to have to take? How is that measured? How is that assessed? So is there a new government agency coming our way? God, I hope not. And it sounds like that's going to be a relatively arbitrary assessment, because I didn't see any metrics steps in the bill. And as a follow-up two-part question, what is the incident rate of this? And maybe Mr. Smith could provide that from his perspective. But so the first question is, who's going to measure this?
Representative Baje.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Nash. So reasonable efforts is a term of art in law. So when this court comes before a judge, the judge will understand what reasonable efforts is. Basically, as we discussed with one of your colleagues, reasonable efforts is really what is customary to be known to be able to show that you are actually trying to do what is required of you. So if a judge sees that a landlord of a larger property has used their website, has probably used a third-party website, that's probably enough for reasonable efforts. But I think the judge needs to take that into a case-by-case basis for someone who would be wanting to bring this claim. Was there another question that I missed?
Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, it was the incident rate of these situations that we're trying to apparently remedy here.
Sure. I can ask Ms. Sterling, or if you would like Mr. Smith to come down.
Yeah, that'd be great if you could.
Okay. I don't have exact numbers for that.
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I'm not aware of that data being collected. Anecdotally, it's a rare occurrence in our industry. We would generally call it a skip or a negotiated early termination, which obviously is always in the best interest of the resident to negotiate an early termination. So it does the least harm to their rental history.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be done with this. So it doesn't seem to be that the pernicious level that it might appear to be in the language of the bill is actually the reality that we see in the field. So thank you.
Representative Vajay, final comments to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee, for your time. I will just say about this bill, we will still continue to work on it. I actually appreciate all the comments. It really helps with things we need to look at under consideration. But finally, you know, what I will say is that what we're trying to do here is clarify what the penalties are, so that way when a judge is looking at a situation, they know at least where to start if a violation has actually occurred. And, you know, again, as we talked about with our landlord-tenant laws last year, these are really to clarify that when the relationship does break down, that we know what rules to follow, but we really do encourage that people keep up their communications and their contacts with their landlords and their tenants so that way we don't have these communication breakdowns. So thank you.
There has been a roll call requested, so Ms. Erdahl will take the roll on the motion, which is to move that House File 3591, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee.
Chair Howard.
Aye.
Vice Chair Agbaje.
Aye.
Lee Johnson.
No.
Representative Cha.
Aye.
Representative Dotsas.
No.
Representative Hassan.
Aye.
Representative Hussein.
Hussein, aye.
Representative Kozlowski.
Aye.
Representative Myers.
Nay.
Representative Nash.
No.
Representative Norris.
Aye.
Representative Perez Vega. Representative Petersburg.
No.
With the vote of 7-5, the bill passes and is on its way. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Next up, we have House File, 3350, Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson, welcome to the Housing Committee, I believe for the first time.
I think so, Mr. Chair.
I will move that House File 3350 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Stevenson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a pretty short and simple bill. What it does is say that properties that participate in Section 42, a federal low-income tax credit program, must limit rent increases to Social Security COLA increases minus 1%, provided that they are serving senior citizens. I want to be very clear, and you'll hear me say this a few times in the course of this presentation, these properties, the properties that we're discussing this bill, are already limited in how much they can increase their rent. This is not a new restriction that this bill places on them. Under current federal law, these properties are not allowed to increase rent more than the increase in area median income, or AMI. What this bill does is it changes the calculation from pegging to AMI to Social Security COLA minus 1% for senior citizens. The reason why Section 42 currently restricts rent increases to area median income is very simple. Basically, the idea behind the program is if you're getting the tax credits that are generated by public dollars to generate low-income affordable housing, that we should limit rent increases so that the housing remains affordable for the people who are living there. And the calculation is based on area median income, which is sensible for a working population. As their income increases, rent is allowed to increase as well. The problem is for senior citizens, their income does not increase in proportion to area median income. By and large, the tenants in these buildings are not working in jobs. And keep in mind that in order to live in one of these buildings, you have to be at a certain income level or below. And we have a much better metric to judge the earning power of the people who live in these buildings. It's Social Security, because that is what they rely upon for their income. So I think of this bill as a change to the formula. We're not going to look at area median income, which is not really applicable to senior citizens. We're going to look at Social Security, which obviously is. That's the right thing to do. It's the fair thing to do. And again, these properties are already limited in what they can increase their rents under existing state and federal law. So this is not a new rent control. This is changing the formula. This bill came to me through work with a number of constituents in my district who live in a building called River North, who have been engaged in a long-running battle with the entity that owns their building, trying to find a fair and equitable way. They're happy with the building. They want to live there, but they can't afford the rent increases that are seen, because the difference between AMI and Social Security can be really dramatic. In 2022, for example, area median income in the Twin Cities went up double digits, more than 12%. Social Security only went up a little less than 6%. It's not fair to ask people who are relying upon their Social Security to fund their housing to be judged against area median income, which is a measure of how working people's wages have increased. So that's the idea behind this bill. Mr. Chair, I know a couple of my constituents are here today to share their story with the committee, and I think there are a few other people as well, and then I'll be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. First, we have Char Golgart. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Char Golgart. I'm a member of the Minnesota Tenant Coalition and a resident of River North Apartments. My building is a publicly subsidized property. The available senior apartments banner on the corner of my building when I moved in drew me in. The annual rent increases based on AMI determined by HUD are squeezing me out. This was to be my forever home. When I moved in December 2016, rent was $1,064. Today it is $1,544. That's a 45% increase. Who gets 45% pay increase in a seven-year period, except maybe corporate CEOs, but certainly not seniors? My Social Security income has increased only 16% since 2017 and is now roughly $20,000 per year. My rent this year will be $18,528. How is this affordable senior housing? I would not qualify to move into this building today. I've worked hard all my life, budgeting carefully to retire debt-free. Today, my budget is tighter than ever. I and many of my neighbors never expected to be living in poverty at this time of our lives. Are we not worthy of a decent home in a safe neighborhood? I gave up internet and cable. I have a cheap Best Buy antenna attached to the wall next to the window. This works well, except when the wind blows. I cannot afford a garage parking. I have to scrape ice and snow off of my 2002 Ford Focus in the worst winter weather. Dinner out might be a quarter pounder with cheese at McDonald's, and that's if my electric bill isn't too high in any given month. We've been told repeatedly that our votes count. We want to believe that our elected politicians will serve our best interests as promised. We desperately need to update an antiquated program that benefits only the developers. There will always be a need for housing. There will always be developers, and there will always be some profit. We need to know that these needs can be filled without greed. Please amend this bill to cover everyone in subsidized affordable housing. We need to implement new solutions that will make this a fair, affordable, and prosperous place to live. We need policies that put housing within reach for everyone. Please vote yes to this bill, not so much by the politics in your minds, but by the humanity in your hearts. Yes, this is about money, but it's equally important to our mental health. We are all living in fear of homelessness. Do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Jan Bregelwoman.
You're doing great.
Hi. Well,
hi there. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name's Jan Bregelman, and I live in the same building that Char lives in. I'm here to ask you to support this bill because my story is very similar to hers. I worked as a nurse 44 years. I saved a lot, and in 2009, $127,000 of my investment went gone like that. I now live in this LIHTC apartment, and I hear people saying you can't support this bill because it's rent control. And as Zach says, it's really low-income housing. So that is a form of rent control. I've been fighting against the corporation for a couple of years and harassing Zach and Abler and Hoffman, my representatives, to the point I think they're my best friends. I send them so many emails. LIHTC is a poorly outdated program that costs the federal government $9 billion per year. And there's a multitude of reasons for profit developers seek these contracts, and it's not for humanitarian reasons. Last year, Dominion built three new buildings. They advertised 6 months free rent up to $10,000 per apartment, plus a $1,000 referral fee. How much money went into that? And you're worried about the developers when we're a hair's breadth away from homelessness. And it just makes me sad that I'm here saying this. And if you look at them, Dominion right now, which is who I'm dealing with, and 17 Dominion properties are part of our coalition, they have over 355 vacancies right now. That's more than a building. And so why build if you can't afford to live there? And we can't. We're just that close. A major issue in this law, the LIHTC program, is the definition of low income. In 2023, federal guidelines, low income was $14,580 for one person. My rent was $18,500. It's 72% of my income. Many tenants, like Mary, who I represent in this building, she has leukemia. Her drugs are $300 to $500 a month, on top of the rent, on top of utilities, on top of food. It's very hard for us to be there, and we're struggling, and we are not asking for a handout. We're asking for the rent to be where we can live and just be comfortable. I love my community. I love my apartment. As I said, Zach and Jim Abler and John Hoffman have been phenomenal, and I believe you're here because you care. And I just want to remind you, this coalition, we're thousands and thousands and thousands of votes, and that's not our family and our friends. And we're watching who votes what because this matters. It's a lifeline we're asking you. Thank you, Mr. Howard and committee.
Thank you. Next, we have Cecil Smith. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Cecil Smith. I'm with the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association. Housing economists are only occasionally united in their opinion, but when it comes to rent control, they are. The vast majority of economists, including Paul Krugman, raise red flags about rent control for one simple reason. It does not work. The unintended consequences outweigh the benefits. Today, the country looks to St. Paul as an example of the negative consequences of rent control. While this proposal is narrowly focused to a specific program, it will eventually mean broader avoidance and divestment. Enacting this bill will ensure Minnesota will not have the supply of senior affordable housing to meet the needs as Minnesota's baby boomers look to downsize into senior rental housing. This proposed regulatory regime will send development capital to other opportunities where their project will be viable. Under this proposal, the operating math for senior LIHTC does not work. The projects will not be viable. Last year, the legislature provided funds for nonprofit housing providers experiencing financial distress. This proposal will only exacerbate the financial challenges those same operators face. If the goal is to create and preserve affordable housing affordability for low and middle income seniors, the state should look at other options, such as supplemental rental assistance. We are also concerned that this bill is retroactive and would interfere with existing funding agreements. Furthermore, retroactively layering a rent control policy would incentivize flipping a property at the end of the required affordability covenant. Given the demographics of our state, Minnesota needs substantially more senior affordable housing in the coming years. This bill undermines that goal. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Our last testifier is Lugene Flores. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Howard and members of the committee. My name is Lugene Flores, and I am a Native American grandmother who has custody of a granddaughter. I am a tenant leader in an affordable housing community in Spring Lake Park, and I've been there for the past 4 years. I am also a member of the Minnesota Tenant Coalition, made up of 17 organized affordable housing properties. My rent has increased $317 per month, while my COLA has increased $107 per month in the past 4 years. I had to income qualify to move into this property. Today, I would not have the income to move into my building. How can someone who gets $16,800 a year afford rent that is $14,400 per year? This fact is why I had to return to work. The current formula used to determine rent is clearly broken. My fear is that in the near future, my granddaughter and I will not be able to afford to stay in our home. As per the supply argument, there are 355 empty affordable units around the metro area in the 60 property portfolio program that I live in. More buildings will not change the fact that my income today no longer qualifies me in my building. We need your help right now. Not in the time it takes to build another affordable apartment that is not affordable. It's important to me that all my neighbors are included in the protections of this bill. It's why I became a leader in the Minnesota Tenant Coalition. What does it say about our values to not care for one another? We urge you to vote yes with amendments to House File 3350 to ensure all my neighbors are included in these protections. Thank you for listening to my testimony.
Thank you. We'll go to members' discussion. First, I have Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and, and to all the testifiers and so forth. And I've talked to a few testifiers earlier today, about an hour ago, and this this is a real issue for individuals and that are really dealing with limited income and so forth. And it sounds to me like this is a real issue dealing with how we deal with low income and how it is determined. I have concerns with this portion of it because I think whereas its attempt is really good, the problem is that the costs of providing this isn't adjusted based upon somebody's income and whether or not it's controlled. And so, for example, if we were to say if the local AMI is whatever percent you want to use, 15%, that usually is reflective of food as well, that grows about the same amount. And yet we wouldn't expect to limit the cost that the grocers could charge based upon somebody's income, okay? This is a situation where we have to understand that there is a cost to it. Now, how we get to where it's affordable for individuals is going to require, I think, some thought on how we do that because it's a real issue. It's an issue in which people who have limited income and have stable, whatever they get is out of their control. And we know that, generally speaking, the COLA that Social Security gives is much less than everybody else's. And yet all the costs for repairs, maintenance, and so forth grows with the same level as all the other inflations. So as you start reducing that level of revenue while still increasing the costs, pretty soon you are going to see people selling the facilities or buildings or whatever down the way, and then they're not available for low income at all. And so we do have to kind of play this juggling act to try to figure out what is the best way of handling this. I appreciate the simpleness of this bill, and I know it's working towards a goal, but the long-term consequences are also there, and it's something that we have to consider. And I know, Mr. Chair, it's up to you for laying it over for possible inclusion, but there are some concerns that this may help short-term, long-term it may not. So I think we need to keep putting our heads together and try to figure out how we can get either more subsidized for building developers or something in order to keep the rents low without just saying, okay, we know your expenses are going up, but you can charge even less than what the inflationary cost is. That's not going to be good in the long run either. So where we go from here is a good question, but I fully understand we need to do something. This is something that's an important issue for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Dotseth.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Howard, Representative. I'll have to just concur with what Representative Petersburg has said. I think it's something we definitely have to look at. I have to value all the testifiers that came down today. I appreciate you coming down and sharing today. It's important for us to hear these situations. But with that, I just ask that the author look at all the unexpected consequences that potentially could come out of this bill. I think right now we're looking at, 355 vacancies. I'm concerned that we may have additional vacancies if we move forward with this bill the way it's written right now. But I guess that we just look at that. We definitely do have an issue, and we need to address it. How we get there, I think we need to work on that a little bit further. Thank you.
We have four members on the list, members, and I'm hoping that we can finish by 4:15 so we have time for our third bill. And next on the list I have Representative Nash.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the author, I don't see an enactment date. When is this to be enacted?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, it'll be August 1st since it's the default date.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do understand that there's a problem, and I appreciate the people who came down to testify. I am concerned August 1st that's going to change a lot of the planned maintenance on many of these buildings, because it's going to change how the housing providers are able to collect rent and the investments that they need to make in deferred maintenance. And it should come as no surprise, because I've said it before, I am opposed to rent control, and it came from a familial connection. So my family came from Norway. They lived in New York City, and there was a rent control apartment that they lived in for a very long time. Progressively, they said, and this was when my grandmother was still alive, and then my uncle and my mom, they all said that with the increase in wear and tear on the building, the building owner, the housing provider, was unable to keep up with deferred maintenance. And eventually it went from a very nice place to live to a place that was not really much to write home about. And my fear is, Representative Stevenson, is that this is setting it up, as Mr. Smith said, to fail in the rent control world, because if you live in a home that you own, you're on the hook for maintenance. If you live in a home that somebody else, they're going to have to make repairs. The only mechanism they have to eventually pay for those repairs is through the collection of rents. So I have some concerns along those lines. I do recognize that there is something to be solved here, but I believe MHFA could have done something along these lines through, you're smiling, that could be inactivity, I guess, but I'll talk to you maybe offline. But I just have deep concerns about the snap of a finger for August of this year to put housing providers in that predicament, because they're the slope of collection ability for rents is not going to keep up with the potential need for deferred maintenance. So for that reason, I'll be voting no.
Go to Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Howard. And I just want to thank Representative Stevenson for bringing this bill forward. I appreciate the opportunity to co-author it with you. I have one of these buildings in my district. The stories that I hear from the residents of that building greatly concern me. I think this is a good step forward. I think there's a lot about these particular buildings that distinguish them from the rest of the apartment rental market, and that this is an appropriate approach to addressing those concerns.
Then I have Lee Johnson.
Chair Howard, Representative Stevenson, I understand what you're trying to do here. I too have some of these buildings. I believe it's four or five in my district. And I've actually had my parents and my mother-in-law. Parents lived in one, my mother-in-law does now, so I understand what the rent issue is. But as the other members of my team have spoke about, it's the deferred maintenance. If this goes into August 1st, there's deferred maintenance that's not going to get taken care of because they won't have the funds, especially with inflation that we've had, that they're going to be able to do the maintenance because the limiting the amount that they have to pay for it. The other issue with the control is, granted, we have mentioned that the one building had 300 and some openings. Our vacancies, but what we found when we what we're seeing when there's the rent control and rent control not only in Minneapolis and St. Paul but elsewhere in the country, the providers quit building. They quit building the apartments for them. They put a lot of investment in them, and they have shareholders that want to, they don't want to lose money. A lot of times they do it for noble causes, not just for the income, but it's their retirement as well. And if they're not building these, where are our seniors, especially our seniors with low income, going to go? There will be no place for them. So we got to be careful how we do things to fix this problem. So I do hope you'll work with the housing providers to figure out a way to deal with this, because they want to have their apartments filled as much as possible. They do not like vacancies because it puts a strain on the rest of the people that live there when there is vacancy. So if they can't build the buildings, at some point they won't be there for our seniors. And I don't want that to happen either. So please work with them, see if we can get something figured out before the end of session, before this bill goes forward. Because it is important. I want to make sure our seniors are taken care of, because they usually go from independent living into assisted living. And we want to make sure that they have what they need towards the end of their life, because
I think it's very important we do that.
I'll go to Representative Stevenson for final comments, but just want to say I appreciate the bipartisan consensus. There's a problem here to solve, and I just appreciate Representative Stevenson, especially your constituents who are bringing forward the solution. So Representative Stevenson, to the bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and you took the words out of my mouth initially. I was going to say I really appreciate the broad consensus in the room that the current program isn't working, that we have a problem. And I just do want to reiterate off the bat, because there was a lot of discussion about being skeptical of rent control and new rent control here. These properties are already rent controlled. Okay, so we're talking about how we're calculating the allowable rent increase, not whether or not there will be rent control, but how are we going to do that, and what's the fairest way to do that? And it's important to not lose track of the why here. Why are these properties rent controlled? And it kind of goes to explains to Representative Petersburg's question about what about groceries. The reason why these properties are controlled and the amount of rent they can increase is because they're getting significant tax credits. The government is giving the owners of these buildings significant amounts of money to provide affordable housing. I think that we heard very clearly that this housing is not affordable. If the housing is costing you 80% of your income, if it's increasing more than double your expected income increase on Social Security COLA, it is not affordable. So we are not getting, as taxpayers, what we are paying for. We're paying for affordable housing, and we're not getting it. And we can fix that for these properties by changing the calculus and going to Social Security COLA instead of AMI. And the last thing I want to point out, and you heard this in the testimony, is that there is, I think to this day, a banner on the side of the building on River North that says affordable housing for seniors. This is how these buildings are marketed. If you are paying 80% of your income, your housing is not affordable. And imagine how you feel driving up to that building every single day or walking up to that building every single day and seeing a banner on the side saying, here's affordable housing, and then seeing your rent increase by more than twice your Social Security COLA. That's not right. It's not fair. And we can change it. So I hope for member support for the bill.
Thank you, Representative. And the bill is laid over for possible inclusion. We have one more bill on the agenda. It's House File 3800. Representative Norris. Representative Norris, would you move your bill?
Yes, Chair Howard. I move House File 3800.
House File 3800 is moved to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And Representative Norris, I understand you have an A2 amendment. Would you briefly describe it?
We do, Chair Howard and members. Nothing lightens the mood in a room like a 12-page amendment to a 90-page bill. But I assure you that this amendment is primarily just some cleanup work, fixing some small little technical pieces of the bill, and then the majority of it is actually cross-references where we needed to update other sections of Minnesota statute to reflect that we're creating this new housing co-op statute. Mr. Cope could go into more detail if anybody has any questions, but that's the high-level overview of the amendment.
I really hope there isn't any discussion to the A2. All those in favor of the A2?
Mr. Chair, a motion to adjourn is always in order with 12-page amendments.
All those in favor of the A2 say aye.
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 Opposed. All right. The A2 is adopted. Representative Norris, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members. House File 3800 essentially aims to fix a square peg into a round hole situation. Currently, housing cooperatives here in the state of Minnesota are incorporated under a whole number of existing statutes, some designed for agricultural co-ops or utility co-ops. We also pull in our nonprofit statutes. Further governance falls under the statutes that govern HOAs. And so, you know, these housing cooperatives, which we believe are a really important part and hopefully a growing part of our affordable housing mix here in Minnesota, are essentially square pegs that we're trying to cram into these various round holes. Minnesota statutes have generally not explicitly contemplated housing cooperatives as their own unique type of housing. As housing cooperatives are becoming increasingly popular, the time has come for us to adopt our own unique housing co-op statute. And that's what this bill does. The goal of this legislation is threefold. First, we want to clarify and streamline the process for housing cooperatives to incorporate and function in Minnesota, thereby hopefully creating more of these co-ops. Second, we want to preserve Minnesota's existing cooperative and housing statutes so that they continue to work for the types of cooperatives and housing types they were initially created for, getting, you know, these housing co-ops out of the hair, if you will, of the ag utilities, common interest ownership communities, et cetera. And then third, we want to streamline access for the funding of housing cooperatives. And we believe that by defining housing cooperatives in statute, private, public, and nonprofit funders will have a set of criterion by which they can evaluate their investments and set their standards. So a couple of things to note with this 90-page bill in front of us. This bill does not repeal any existing statutes. Second, this bill incorporates pieces of existing law from throughout the statute into a consolidated section, a new 308C. That contributes to most of the bill's length. We're taking, you know, in all of our corporate form statutes, we have to have more or less the same section on a board of directors, the same section on articles of organization. And so that contributes to most of the heft of the bill. Also importantly, this bill will not reincorporate housing cooperatives who have already incorporated under our current co-op statutes, like 308A and 308B. Instead, existing cooperatives, housing cooperatives, will have to elect to proactively reincorporate under the new 308C statute. Housing cooperatives may choose to stay incorporated under their existing statutes, and new housing cooperatives, if they wanted to, could continue to choose to use those existing statutes. And lastly, there's no fiscal impact to this bill. Lastly, I want to include a couple of thank yous and shout outs. First, to our bipartisan co-authors of the legislation here in the House. I appreciate my co-authors, Chair Howard and Representative Feist. On the Senate side, we've actually got bipartisan authorship. Chair Port, along with Senator Westrum. So to my friends on the Republican side, there's still time to join me if you're interested. Want to thank Mr. Cope in particular. He has done incredible work pulling this bill together and helping to craft the summary and the amendments of the bill. We have a huge, diverse coalition of cooperatives who have helped to shape this bill and are supportive of the bill. And then I would also like to thank my two testifiers here today. First, Kim Lowe, a cooperative law attorney with Advise and Legal, who helped author the legislation. She'll be available to answer technical questions related to the bill. I also would be remiss if I didn't note that it's a little bit of nostalgia being here at the testifier table with Ms. Lowe. About 10 years ago, we teamed up here at the Capitol to create the Benefit Corporation statute that is still going strong about a decade later, and so it's great to be able to be back in the saddle working on another corporate forum with her. And then we've got Joel Hansen, Advocacy and Communications Manager at the North Country Cooperative Foundation, who can answer questions specifically related to the functionality of housing cooperatives.
Thank you. We'll go to Ms. Lowe first.
Thank you, Chair Howard. So as Representative Norris said, we've been at this a few times in the last 10 years. I am a business law lawyer here in the state of Minnesota. I also happen to be one of Minnesota's uniform law commissioners, and I'm also a member of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and I chair the co-op group there. I am an ag co-op lawyer, a housing co-op lawyer, a marketing co-op lawyer. You name co-ops, I've done them, and I've also done several manufactured home cooperatives and other cooperatives and struggled with how we reconcile a housing co-op with our current legislative structures and the funding sources that are there for them. So the purpose of this statute is to create that ideal structure that works for what we have available, one for funding, two for governance, and three for the groups of people that want to do this. remarkably, or generally, it tends to be senior housing cooperatives. We heard a little bit about senior housing earlier. Senior housing cooperatives, limited equity cooperatives, which is a movement moving around the country, as well as we have leasehold cooperatives, where we have groups that say they want to do a cooperative that's attached to a university housing program. So those are the universes that we're trying to address with this statute. I can go into as much detail or as little detail as you want on this 91-page document. This is not my first rodeo on our corporate statutes, so most of what is in here, as Representative Norris has said, is duplicated from our existing statutes, which we have for how we do meetings and all this other stuff. And then it has an overlay or the addition of what's needed for housing.
Thank you. Next, we have Joel Hansen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Howard and members of the committee. I'll try to make my testimony brief. But just from the standpoint of those who work in the cooperative space and the affordable housing space, this bill is the byproduct of conversations that began in the summer of 2023 amongst a group of stakeholders within cooperative housing. And so I would just like to highlight that involved us at North Country Cooperative Foundation, but also folks at the Cooperative Network, along with Riverton Community Housing, who represents a lot of student housing, and the leasehold model, as Kim referenced, and the Senior Housing Cooperative Council, so it represents senior housing co-ops here in the state. This is also supported by the Metropolitan Consortium of Community Developers, MCCD, and then the City of Minneapolis has also expressed their support in a letter. So it's a wide array of folks that are in this space that view this as being something that's going to streamline the process and hopefully create more housing cooperatives throughout Minnesota.
Thank you. Any discussion to the bill? If not, I'll go to Representative Norris for any final comments.
Thank you, Chair Howard. And I, again, just want to echo my thanks for everyone who worked hard to put this together. This is going to be a really valuable tool in our affordable housing toolbox for Minnesota moving forward. And I encourage the committee support for it.
With that, I renew Representative Norris's motion that House Bill 3800 be laid over for possible inclusion, and the bill is laid over. Thank you, Representative Norris. With that, members, we are adjourned. We'll see you tomorrow.